How many of you have ever walked around in a maze? Not in a daze. We've all done that. But a maze. Yeah, I don't like mazes. I'm a little claustrophobic, and I don't think anybody who's claustrophobic should go in a maze. People who are claustrophobic shouldn't be in a maze. They shouldn't be in submarines. There's a lot of places we shouldn't be. I'm not even that thrilled about being in an airplane, to be honest with you, even though it's a big thing and has wings. I guess the last, and I tend to get frustrated in a maze. The last time I went in one, I made the mistake, was about 2 years ago. Cindy and I had two of our granddaughters out at a little pumpkin patch in October, and there was a maze cut through a cornfield. And it wasn't a huge maze, and it wasn't complicated, but I wasn't going in there. I know, maze, death, maze. But one of my oldest granddaughter, Madeline, was about 4 at the time, and she kept saying, "Pops, I want to go in there. Pops, I want," and I kept saying, "Nah, let's get some cotton candy. Pops, I want to go in there. Oh, let's get your face painted like a cat." But finally, after she was revved up on cotton candy and had a cat face, she said, "Pops, take me to the maze." Well, you know, Pops took her to the maze. And within about 3 minutes, it wasn't a complicated maze, but of course, I was completely lost. Every time I took a turn, it was a dead end. And I'd take another turn, and it was a dead end. And it was frustrating because you could hear the traffic and the people outside, so you knew life was going on, but not in the maze. And after about 5 minutes, I think Madeline began to pick up on my frustration. She said, "Pops, do you know how to get out of here?" I said, "Sure, sweetheart, sure. After about 2 more minutes, I thought, the way to get out of here, I'm picking this kid up, I'm going to crash through this corn, I'm going to head for the sounds of life, and we're going to come out the other end. And that's not an exaggeration. Thankfully, about that time, an 8-year-old version of Edmund Hillary showed up and let us. That kid knew how to get out. He didn't even work there. But he said, "Do you guys know how to get out here?" I said, "Why don't you just show us and we'll follow you?" The kid led us to safety. You know, before then, people say, "I've seen an angel in my life." And I'd say, "Yeah, right. I've seen an angel." You know, the whole concept of mazes or labyrinths was invented by the Greeks. The Greeks used them, thousands of years ago. They invented them. They used them for religious purposes, for decoration, for recreation. But in Western culture, they caught on in the 18th and 19th centuries. The English and French nobility became very, very fixated on mazes. And they'd grow these huge mazes on their properties, and they'd hold parties, and they'd be maze parties. And people would go in the maze and get lost and get frustrated. Probably some died. But they would even make platforms. They'd even build platforms over the mazes for these parties where you could go up and look down on the people in the maze. And that's the only way to view people who are in a maze. You look down on them. There's something wrong with you if you voluntarily went into a maze. They'd even have sometimes teams where you could, be on a platform and yell directions to your teammates below. Whatever the maze is, whatever maze you find yourself in, in my opinion, it's a frustrating experience. And thankfully, since I don't live in France or England, I haven't been in one of those mazes. But The Shining, remember The Shining? Remember the maze in The Shining? That is probably the most honest depiction of what happens in a maze. Crazy guy with an axe. Next time you're going in a maze, just think crazy guy with an axe. And you've been warned. Well, you're running through the maze next time, fleeing from that guy. I said, "Beswick told me this. He told me this." You know, sometimes life can seem like you're living it in a maze, especially when we're experiencing difficulty or stress. You ever been in that position in your life where you're trying to make your way through a situation in your life, and it's a difficult one? Maybe it's a medical emergency. Maybe it's something that's job-related. Maybe it's a health issue. Maybe it's the death of someone we love. Whatever that situation, we're in it and we can't seem to get out of it. We desperately want to get out of it. But every turn we take seems to lead to a dead end. We know there is a desired goal, but that goal seems very elusive and hidden from us. And all we do is we continue to make turns, and we pray that somehow someone will show us the way out of the maze. As we go back to Esther today, Esther chapter 6, the expatriate nation of Israel finds itself in a maze. And they've been in that maze for at least several days, maybe even several weeks by this time. It is a maze not of their own construction. After over 100 years in peaceful captivity in the Persian Empire, one day every one of those expatriate Jews woke up to find themselves in a maze, to find themselves in a maze that was constructed overnight by one man, Haman. It was a maze that was constructed by one edict, an edict that declared that on the 13th day of Adar, every one of those people would be killed. There was nothing they could do about it. They couldn't flee. There was no place to go. And when the 13th day of Adar came around, they weren't even to defend themselves. They were dead. They were dead. They know there's a desired destination. The desired destination is pretty easy, or pretty obvious anyway. The desired destination, if somebody's going to say you're going to die, what's your desired destination? Yeah, survival. Yeah, survival. But that destination seems very obscure and hidden. There doesn't seem to be any way out. The good news is, unseen and unheard, God is actively working out His plan for His people. Carefully, deliberately, we can almost picture God standing over the maze that is the Persian Empire, watching the frantic activity below Him, and very calmly directing all things to His good and His glory. Today, we're going to join God on the observation deck as we look at chapter 6. We're going to watch as God masters the Persian maze. We're going to just look at the first 5 verses of chapter 6. During that night, the king could not sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of records, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. It was found written what Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. The king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." So the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows which he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, "Behold, Haman is standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." You know, the venerable Jewish comedian Henny Youngman, you know, he's still alive. He's like 197. But he's the oldest man in the world, Henny Youngman. I wouldn't even mention his ethnicity, except if Haman had gotten his way in Esther 6, there wouldn't have been a Henny Youngman. But Henny Youngman was the king. Well, do you remember what his nickname was? The king of one-liners. The king of one-liners for 200. Who was the king of one-liners? Henny Youngman. Well, one of Henny Youngman's little jokes was, he said, and he always had a violin. He said, "My wife said, smile. Things could be worse." So I smiled. She was right. Things got much worse. Thank you, Henny Youngman. You know, over the past several chapters in Esther, if you were Jewish and living in the Persian Empire, you had nothing to smile about. Haman's law for your extinction had been communicated through the entirety of the kingdom. Everybody knew it, and everybody was getting ready to kill you. Esther has agreed to intervene on your behalf. But really, what's Esther done by this point? By the time chapter 5 closes, what's Esther done? Yeah, she fed them a very nice meal. She gave Ahasuerus and Haman a very nice meal. She hadn't brought up the issue. All she had done was feed them. Now, that's a predicate to what's going to happen, but from a human standpoint, that's all that happened. I mean, I know the old adage that, you know, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, but that's stretching it. That's stretching it. And the clock was winding down. 0 hour for the Jewish people was what? The 13th day of Adar. We don't know exactly when that was, but it was coming. It was coming. And don't you know, if you were Jewish and you knew exactly what the day of your death was, every morning you would wake up and look at that calendar. Every day you would live with the absolute certainty that on this date, this near date, I'm dying. And there would be nothing you could do about it. But there was another deadline. And that deadline was unknown to everybody but Haman. What was the second deadline? We know it's the 13th day of Adar, but there was another deadline in place. It was what? Hanging Mordecai. And as chapter 5 closed, that deadline was just hours away. The gallows were being constructed. Nobody but Haman knew that deadline, but that deadline was as much in place, because was there any reason for Haman to believe that Ahasuerus would deny his request to hang Mordecai? Of course not. Ahasuerus is his bud. They're best friends. He's second in command. Come on. To ask to hang this indescript person, this unimportant person, that's going to happen. Now, you know, the only thing worse at this point than being a Jew in the Persian Empire is being Mordecai in the Persian Empire. You know? I mean, of all the woes that are befalling the Jewish people, the only thing worse is being Mordecai. From a human standpoint, from a human perspective, all is lost. But, of course, the Bible's not presented from strictly a human perspective. God has given us a deific perspective, and we're going to look at that. We're going to look at that. Even as Esther oversees her menu, even as Haman constructs his gallows, God's at work. Look at the first verse. It said, during that night, the king could not sleep. Literally, the phrase reads, the sleep of the king fled. You ever had those nights when sleep flees? Yeah, it's the sleep of the king fled. You know, this is a pivotal verse in the history, in the story of Esther. If you were hearing the story of Esther for the first time, if you were a young Jewish boy or girl, and you were in the synagogue, and the priest or the rabbi was teaching this story for the first time, you'd know some facts. You'd know about the injustice that was coming. You'd know about who were the victims of that injustice. They were your people. You'd know about the antagonist, Haman. For the first time, though, you really get a clear view of God's providence. It's, when did this happen? What does it say? Verse 1 starts what? During the night. During that night. That night. It says, during that night. That specific night. That night following the first banquet at which Esther was laying the groundwork for her request. That night during which Haman was constructing the gallows. That night during which the king could not sleep. Not one night earlier, not one night later. You know, God is very specific in his plan. God's plan, if anything, God is a micromanager. Ever think about that? God micromanages his people. God's plan is micromanagement because God is in the details. That night, that specific night. You know, when we think of the attributes of God, one of the many attributes of God we have is that God is timeless. We talk about the timelessness of God. And when we talk about the timelessness of God, we tend to think in terms of what? God has always been what? He's been always in existence. He's pre-existence. We talk about eternity, and we think, well, that means God existed a million years ago, and God can remember all the things that happened a million years ago, and God exists today, and God can look into the future, and God sees everything. You know, the reality is, one of God's attributes, when we say God is timeless, is that God is always dealing in a present tense. For us, there is a past, a present, and a future. For God, everything is presently before him. That's remarkable to me. When I try to remember things that happened 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you know, it gets to be more and more of a stretch. But I can remember what happened immediately in front of me. God sees what we view as the past, the present, and the future as a present reality. Everything is presently in front of God. Remember back in John chapter 8, Jesus is talking to two of his favorite groups of people, the scribes and the Pharisees, guys he used to eat with all the time. You know, for a group of people that Jesus didn't particularly care for, he did spend a lot of time with them. But he was talking to the scribes and Pharisees they always thought about. And he closes chapter 8 with a statement that causes the scribes and Pharisees to pick up stones to stone him. And that statement is very familiar. It says, he said, before Abraham was, I am. You notice he didn't say before Abraham was, I was. No. He said before Abraham was, I am. I've always existed. There is the present. With God in a very real sense, there is no past, present, or future. Everything with God is in the present. That means that in our lives, whatever you and I are going through is presently and immediately before God. Whatever difficulties we have are presently, and God addresses them in the present tense. He doesn't try to remember what he was supposed to do. He doesn't have to foresee what he's going to do. Everything in our lives is presently before God. That should be a real comfort to each one of us. There is an immediacy of that relationship. That night, this happened. This is a night that was predestined. This is a night that was scheduled and choreographed since prior to Genesis 1:1, that night. Now, what did his sleep do? His sleep fled. This indicates, and to the first time here, this would indicate this wasn't just some normal bout of sleeplessness. This wasn't just, well, you know, Ahasuerus had too much caffeine. You know, drank way too much tea that night. And he just couldn't get to sleep. His sleep actively eluded him. The best sleep number mattress. It didn't matter what number he would have turned it to. It didn't matter. The guy was not going to sleep. You know, when I was looking at that verse, I thought, well, you know, there were other times we saw insomniacs in the Bible. Can you remember any other insomniacs of the Bible we know and love? David slept. Or David was awake. When David was awake, usually what would that be, though? An opportunity for what? And of course, when was the one time we saw David couldn't sleep? Yeah, with Bathsheba. And that wasn't presented as an act of God. Who else? Pilate's wife. Remember her tune? She came to Pilate, and she said what to Pilate? Have nothing to do with that man. I mean, I've been up all night. I've had visions. I've had dreams. That's the bad juju. You know, don't have anything to do with this guy. Yeah, there was somebody who was being kept awake by her insomnia was a result of bad dreams. What else? Remember a guy named Nebuchadnezzar? Nebuchadnezzar back in Daniel 2. What woke Nebuchadnezzar up? Dreams. He dreamed about what? Cows and corn. How bad can that be? The guy dreamed about cows and corn. Fat cows, skinny cows, plump corn, fat corn, skinny corn. That was Pharaoh. What did Nebuchadnezzar dream about what? The trees and the statues. The trees and statues, right? And Pharaoh. Pharaoh was troubled with his dream of the cows and the corn. Can you remember a guy named Darius, again in Daniel? He never got to sleep. You remember what he was worrying about? Daniel in the lion's den. Daniel in the lion's den. Yeah, so we have pictures. By the way, when was it? About 4 or 5 months ago, the History Channel ran a series called The Bible. Anybody ever channel surf past that? You know, I would look at it, and it would make me mad. And I'd turn it off, and then I'd go back to the time, and I'd look at it and make me mad, and I'd turn it off. And one of the things I channel surfed over to, and they were doing Daniel in the lion's den. I just happened to channel surf over when they were doing Daniel in the lion's den. So, what's wrong with this picture? They show Daniel, about 35, 36 years old, big strapping young man, being led in chains to the lion's den. And it was like a cave underground. And there was a nice bar, set of bars, like you see in the jail of Mayberry RFD. And they opened the bars, and they shoved him in and locked the door. And there, of course, the lions were laying around, roaring. So what's wrong? What are some of the things that are wrong with that picture? They what? They lowered him from the top. That's right. It was a pit. It wasn't the Fort Worth Zoo. And that's why I said, this isn't the Fort Worth Zoo. They lowered him into a pit. Daniel was about 65, 66 years old when this happened. He wasn't a big, strong, strutting man. He was about 65, 66 years old when he was lowered by a rope into this pit, this dark pit of lions. Not a 35-year-old man who was let in. They opened the gate, tossed him in there, and they had torches on the wall so you could see what was going on. And I thought, they have it in writing. Okay? You don't even have to write that script. It's there. Anyway, I think the important thing here is that throughout the Bible we see people kept awake, but they're kept awake by worry. They're awakened by bad dreams, by visions. Here, Ahasuerus never gets to sleep. He never gets to sleep. This is divine insomnia. This is deific insomnia. He never gets to sleep. We see God's hand here. So what does he do? If you can't get to sleep, you read a book. If you can't get to sleep, what do? Yeah, I've got basic cable. Ahasuerus didn't have basic cable. You know, no matter what condition we find our lives in, no matter where we live, no matter how big our house is, do you realize we all have a standard of living that is infinitely better than anything Ahasuerus had. You know, the car we drive home in, that's better than the chariot he had. Whatever we eat today, it's better than the food he had. Whatever our homes are, it's better than the home Ahasuerus had. But Ahasuerus, lacking basic cable, he calls for a book. He calls for a book. Of course, I love this. And you notice what it says. He calls for the book of records, the Chronicles. Now, did they have books? First of all, did they have books? No, what'd they have? Scrolls. And these were massive scrolls. These scrolls would be about normally 10 to 15 feet long. They'd be written on both sides, and they'd be about 2 feet wide. Some of these scrolls or portions of these scrolls still exist. That's a massive scroll. Think of all you could write on something that was 10 to 15 feet long. You write on both sides. It's massive. It's massive. The kings of Persia kept detailed records of their reign. They preserved their legacy. And they would write down, I mean, if you were going to preserve your legacy and you were an important ruler, what were some of the things you'd write down? What were some of the things you'd talk about? Your battles. Absolutely. Their battles and wars were chronicled. Now, I would bet that Greece, that whole campaign in Greece, was a small footnote. Went to Greece for 2 years. Didn't like the food. You know, lost 400,000 men in my navy. Came home humiliated. Now, it's probably a footnote. You talk about the wars. What else would you talk about? Yeah, your great feats. You know, your decrees. You talk about the foreign emissaries who would come and visit you or trips you'd take. You talk about the big things. Here's the thing. Ahasuerus, as we noted back in chapter 1, had a secretary that got up with him every morning. When Ahasuerus got up, his secretary joined him. That secretary spent the day writing down everything Ahasuerus did. Can you imagine how boring your life would be if you had to sit at the end of the day and read everything you did that day? I mean, wouldn't that put you to sleep? You know, there might have been a few exciting things, but most of it is you had a sandwich for lunch. And chips. You think, gosh, that's my life? But they would write down virtually everything. They would just catalog what they did. Now, usually, if a king called for a chronicle, and it looks at, you know, when we read this, it was the book of records. There were thousands and thousands of scrolls. The chronicles. That's what they really were. There were thousands of these scrolls that they would keep, that they would catalog and have in storage. When a king would call for a chronicle or one of the books of records, he would rarely call for his own chronicle. The only time, in fact, that a king would call for his own chronicle, when do you think one of the few times would be? If he wanted to what? Yeah, if you want to check on something, if you wanted to verify something, if an issue arose, they said, well, what did you say then? Well, the king could say, well, get me the book. Or if they said, what did you do then? The king could say, well, get me the book. So if the king wanted to know specifically something that he had ordered, something that he had directed, in that very limited instance, he would call for that scroll to be brought. But normally when a king called for a scroll, what do you think he'd be looking for? Normally, he'd get one of his predecessor's scrolls. He'd read about what his daddy had done or his grandfather had done. He'd look for wisdom. The kings referred to prior rulers to get wisdom, to get some direction. Rarely would they consult current events. So when he says, bring me the record, it was the book of records, the Chronicles. He wasn't asking for anything in specific. He was just saying, bring me something. Bring something to be read to me. He wasn't directing the scribe, the servant, to any particular one. And a book of records was brought to him. So what has God done so far with Ahasuerus in these few verses? He's really just done a couple things. First of all, he's done what? Kept him awake. Second thing he's done? Yeah, he ordered the book. He'd ordered the book. That's it. You know, and from a human standpoint, those seem like two rather small things. And they are details. But God is in the details. God specifically orchestrates his will. We know how the story ends. We know how the story goes. That when the scroll comes, it talks about a specific event. We think, well, goodness, if I was God, I would have just caused Ahasuerus to remember that event. No, that wasn't the right way to do it. God does it the right way. That's verse 2. You can imagine Ahasuerus, as verse 2 opens up. You can imagine Ahasuerus lying in his bed. His scribe is sitting on a chair next to him, just reading him out of the scroll. He's unrolling this scroll. It's a huge scroll. These things weigh pounds. You know, none of those, what are they, the golden rule books? What did we read to our kids? Those little golden books? I guess they still have those. What are they called? The golden books, yeah, those nice little things, you know, weigh 6 ounces. No, these were massive scrolls. So, quite frankly, the scribe would not have been looking for anything in particular. He would have just opened the scroll to where it started, and he would have just started reading. Again, a 10 to 15 foot long scroll on both sides, he just opens and starts reading. More, I'm sure Ahasuerus is starting to drift off. He's laying there listening to, you know, the mundane things of court. You know, on Tuesday, Persephone brought you a sword. And the king was very pleased. And then the king had a very nice piece of lamb for supper. And on Wednesday, you know, Monocles came in and said that Persephone had stolen his sword on Tuesday and had given it to the king. And on Wednesday, the king hung Pericles and Persephone because he was annoyed with both of them. And then it was movie night. You know, just listening to this drivel, just listening to this, and Ahasuerus is starting to drift off. This is boring stuff. This is working. And suddenly the scribe begins to read something that catches Ahasuerus' attention. It's like if you're ever listening to television. So, you know, my generation was that first television generation. And sometimes I still turn on the television on low volume to, you know, help me go to sleep sometimes. And But occasionally, you know, Bonanza, oh, come on, I'll wake up. I recognize that song. Well, Bonanza came on. You know, Bonanza came on. The scribe's reading. He's talking about people getting hung. Yeah, big deal. He's talking about what he ate for dinner. Okay, that's fine. But all of a sudden, he starts to talk about a time. It was found written what Mordecai had reported. Wait a minute. About these two guys, Bigthana and Teresh. And Ahasuerus probably opened his eyes and said, wait a minute. I haven't thought about those guys in years. Wait, what happened? And he starts listening. And the scribe, he keeps reading. He tells about how this plot had been discovered against Ahasuerus' life. And Ahasuerus kind of sits up. He says, yeah, I remember that. I remember those guys. And the scribe reads, and the king investigated. And Ahasuerus is up now, and his eyes are, yeah, I investigated. And the scribe says, and it was found that they were guilty, and the king hung them. And Ahasuerus is up now. The adrenaline's pumping. He's feeling good. I remember those jerks. Yeah, how dare they come at the king. I hung them. You know, that was Esther's first public hanging. You know, and, you know, you ever want to look good, take the queen with you to a public hanging. She did really well. I remember that. Now Ahasuerus is wide awake, and the scribe, more importantly, God has his complete attention. Now Ahasuerus is focused all of a sudden. Ahasuerus hadn't thought about Mordecai ever. I mean, he had never considered Mordecai. We know because 4 or 5 years have passed since this happened. And yet, now he's focused on Mordecai. God's got his attention. Normally, in that record, normally after those lines were written, you know what the next lines would talk about? The reward. Absolutely. As we noted back in chapter 2 when we talked about Mordecai's service, the Persian kings operated on a zero balance budget when it came to good deeds and service. If you did a good deed for the king, you were rewarded immediately. That kept the king free from personal obligation. You couldn't come back to him at a later time and say, well, gee, I know I kind of messed up now, but, you know, back then you didn't reward me. Kept the king free and clear. He kept his books clean. It also made good sense from a public relations standpoint. I mean, it made the king look generous. It made him look benevolent in the eyes of the people. And it just made common sense anyway. I mean, if you were just a drone in the Persian Empire, what vested interest did you really have in Ahasuerus or any king? You know, you didn't vote him in. You never would see the king. The only time you would see the king was through his agents who might come in and drag your son off to the army or collect more taxes, shake you down. And it didn't matter if Ahasuerus was the king or if his brother was the king or if his cousin was the king. You know, if every day you got up in the Persian Empire, you hooked your plow to the back of that ox and you spent your day walking through the fields, you know something? The rear end of an ox looks the same no matter if Ahasuerus is the king or anybody else is the king. But if you know that a good deed, a good service to the king is rewarded, all of a sudden you have a vested interest in Ahasuerus. You have a vested interest in whoever is the king. It is in your best interest to look for something you can do to stand out from the crowd, to please the king, because you're going to be rewarded. It just made common sense. It just made common sense. So the scribe read. He read about Mordecai, and he read about Bigthana, and he read about the other guy, and he read about the hanging. And Ahasuerus is just waiting now. He's sitting back, and he's going to hear now. And the king graciously granted Mordecai, you know, this land or this these talents of gold or silver. But instead, the scribe says, and at supper, the king and queen had a salad because you had a big lunch. You know, and that's not what Ahasuerus was going to hear. That's not what Ahasuerus wanted to hear. Ahasuerus says, stop, stop, stop. What does it say? The king said, wait a minute. What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? Wait a minute. Stop right there. This had Mordecai's interest. What did I do for this guy? I see what he did for me. Don't tell me about what I had for dinner. What did I do for him? Okay. Way back in chapter 2, Mordecai does this good deed. That's 4 or 5 years ago. This was right after Esther was married by Ahasuerus. So we're 5 years down the line now. Mordecai does this good deed. Mordecai, do you think Mordecai expected to be rewarded? Absolutely. Do you think Esther expected Mordecai to be rewarded? Absolutely. Do you think all of Mordecai's friends who knew about this expected Mordecai? Absolutely. Everybody expected Mordecai to be rewarded. And everybody knew he had not been rewarded. You can imagine the response of Mordecai's friends and family members. You know, hey, Mordecai, you might mention this to Esther again. You know, she might mention to the king. You have, in the eyes of the world, Mordecai's failure to cash in was what? It was foolish. It was a lost opportunity. I mean, go for it now. Jump in now. But Mordecai, remember at that time, we said Mordecai was content to wait on the Lord. Mordecai showed patience. Mordecai allowed God to be in control. It's so important when we are confronted with something like Mordecai was, our natural impulse is to follow it through, to see it to its end, not to wait, you know, to shortcut. Mordecai was content in chapter 2 to wait on the Lord. Now in chapter 6, we see that God, in effect, banked Mordecai's good deed, that God himself banked it. Ahasuerus would have been astounded. Look, it says, the king said, what honor has been given him? The king's servant said what? Nothing. And you know who they said it just like? Sergeant Schultz in Hogan's Heroes. That's just, nothing? You did nothing? That's exactly what they sounded like. Because they were from that area of the Persian Empire. That's how I hear it in here. When the voices come to me, that's how they sound. Yeah. The servant said nothing. You have done nothing. This was astounding to Ahasuerus. This would have hit him in the face like a thunderclap. Why? What did this mean? He owed him. The king owed him. And even worse, how long had he owed him? 5 years. Now let me ask you. At this point, did Ahasuerus owe Mordecai the same as he owed him 5 years ago? Less than he owed him 5 years ago, or more than he owed him? Oh, so much more. So much more. That good deed was like a certificate of deposit in times when there's good interest. Not now. But there were times when a certificate of deposit actually gained interest. But that good deed was like a certificate of deposit, and every day that passed, interest was added. Mordecai was, or Ahasuerus, rather, was more indebted to Mordecai every single day. And what's interesting is that Ahasuerus recognized that. Let me tell you something. Ahasuerus was not a godly man. The impact this had on Ahasuerus was a godly impact. This was imposed. Every day that passed, Ahasuerus realized that his indebtedness to Mordecai grew. The days, the months, the years passed. No one was keeping track except who? God. God was keeping track. God micromanages. And just because we can't see that, it doesn't mean that it's not going on. God's in the details. There's no aspect, no moment, no event in your life or mine that is not part of God's eternal plan and that has not been orchestrated by God for His glory and your good. That is an obvious truth that we overlook time and time again. And we can't see it. We're too close. We're too close to see that broad picture. That's why God preserves the examples of how He works in His Word. Because what God is saying to you and me today is, look, this is how I was working in 486 BC. That's still how I work today. This micromanaging, that's how I worked in Mordecai's life. That's how I work in your life. That's why I work in yours. Ahasuerus panics. You see, in verse 5, he panics. And as soon as he finds out he hadn't done anything, he called. He called for his advisors. He said, who's in the court? We've seen his advisors before. Back in chapter 1, after Vashti, the advisors rushed to him with a great idea. After Greece, the advisors rushed to him with a great idea. Ahasuerus is looking for advice. He says, who's in the court? Now, keep in mind, this is probably sometime before daylight. Normally, who's in the king's court sometimes before daylight? A few servants. A few servants, that would be it. No advisors. The guards would be there. The servants, a couple servants, might have gotten up early just so they make sure that somebody's on hand. But normally, where would Ahasuerus be? Sound asleep. Normally, where would Haman be? Sound asleep. He'd be dreaming. What do you think Haman dreamed about? He dreamed about probably his wealth. His family, his power, the same three things he focused on last week. Normally, Ahasuerus is asleep in his bedchamber. Normally, Haman is at home, sound asleep, dreaming of what a great guy he is. But God is the one who really determines what's normal. We look and try to determine what's normal, but God determines what's normal. And on that day, following that night, God determined that normal called for Haman to be present in the outer court of the king. You know, it's interesting because Haman had come. It said Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace. Who's the last person we saw in the outer court of the king's palace? Esther. Isn't it interesting that the only two times in the book of Esther where the outer court is mentioned is when Esther is in the outer court, the hope of Israel, and when Haman, the enemy of Israel, is in the outer court. Esther is coming with a petition for salvation. Haman is coming with quite a different agenda. What has brought Haman to the outer court? Now, in a broad sense, in a universal eternal sense, why is Haman there? Because God's brought him there. Because God has brought him. Now, does this mean that God has directed Haman to commit a sinful act? No. This means that God, in effect, has allowed Haman to follow the sin of his own heart unchecked. That's what this means, is that Haman is there, and we know why, and we'll get there in a minute, but this is not because God has said, yeah, I'm sending Haman there. I'm going to put it in Haman's heart to do this, and I'm going to drive him to the palace. No, God has not initiated sin. God has simply taken off the restraint and allowed Haman to follow the sinful desires of his own heart. From Haman's standpoint, why is he there? Yeah, to see about hanging Mordecai. He wanted to see the king. And look at how urgent this is. Is there really, from a practical standpoint, is there any reason why Mordecai has to be hung at 8 a.m. instead of 3 p.m.? No. No, unless you want to do it before school. You know, you want to get the kids off to school. So I hang him first, get the kids off to school. The principal's retiring. So there's a party. There's a party that Haman has to get to. Because that's the kind of person who goes to a principal's retirement party. Haman. But, you know, so maybe Haman has a reason to get out early. I don't know. But there's a sense of urgency. But when we get down to it, what drove Haman? We know his request, but what was at the bottom of that request? What was the foundation of that request? Pride. Absolutely. Haman's pride drove him out of bed and all the way to the palace. Haman's pride put him in the outer court. Remember, last week we said pride is oblivious. Haman has come. Here's a great example of pride being oblivious. Haman has come to ask Ahasuerus' permission to murder Mordecai. He's oblivious to what fact? The king loves Mordecai. Mordecai's the best guy, best friend the king ever had. I mean, the king just read about how Mordecai saved his life. The king's tearing his hair out trying to figure out how he can do something great for Mordecai. Haman's oblivious. He's coming to kill this guy. He doesn't see any problem with that. We said that pride is vulnerable. Haman has come with a request of Ahasuerus, but he's come with no backup plan. There's no plan B. We see this. We'll see this next week, because when Ahasuerus says, I'm going to honor this guy Mordecai, Haman has no response. He's vulnerable. He's come with a petition, but no defense. And of course, pride is insatiable. Despite everything that Haman has, what's the one more thing that's going to make him happy? That's it, Mordecai dead. If you'll kill Mordecai, then I'll be happy. But the reality of pride is, if Mordecai had swung on the gallows, what would have happened the next day? Would Haman have been any more satisfied? Absolutely not. He would have crowed for a day, and the next day his pride would have said, what you need now is this. Ahasuerus summons Haman. And as Haman enters the throne room, as Haman enters the presence of the king, Haman thinks he's coming into honor. Instead, Haman is taking another turn in the maze that leads to his own dead end. Think about what God has done in just these few verses. In just these few verses, he's denied sleep to the king. He has directed the selection of reading material out of the thousands of scrolls, out of the millions of lines. He has directed that one scroll and those two or three lines about Mordecai. He has pricked the conscience of the king. He has emphasized the debt of the king to him. And he's led Haman into the court for destruction. In just a few verses. Now, while God was up all night doing this, what was Mordecai doing? He was asleep. What was Esther doing? She was asleep. What were all the expatriate Jews who were under a death sentence doing? They were asleep. While they slept, God worked for their good and his glory. That is a perfect picture of the reality of God's working today. You know something? Tonight you and I will go to sleep. But God will be actively working out his plan in our lives. We don't have to be awake. God is not only giving us that protection, you know, we pray for, you know, God, protect us as we sleep, protect our families. God is actively working out his plan in our lives. He doesn't need our participation. He graciously allows our participation. But even while we sleep, you know, Psalm 121:4 says, our God neither slumbers nor sleeps. But while we slumber, while we sleep, God is actively working out his plan in our lives. That is a great reminder for us. And it is a great comfort to each one of us that when we close our eyes at night, even as we drift off, God is actively working in our lives. And you know something? That means that when we wake up, God's plan is further along in our lives than it was when we went to sleep. God's glory is greater. The good that God has done for us, it's greater. Because that's the way God works. Next week, we see the irony as Mordecai is exalted and Haman is brought low. What does this remind us? Well, last week we looked at Haman's pride, at the issue of pride. And Haman's pride was rather passive. If you remember, Haman bragged, he sulked, he boasted, he complained. But it was a rather passive pride. But pride never remains passive. Pride always seeks to actively extend itself to get that one more thing. Haman has gone from simply boasting and pouting and bragging and whining to where he has had a gallows built and he has actively gone to request permission to murder another individual. Let me tell you something. We may never find ourselves, hopefully, building a gallows or requesting permission to kill somebody. But our pride, unchecked, will lead us down the same path of deception and destruction. We need to be aware of that. But on a more positive note, we're reminded that our lives are firmly in the hands of God. God micromanages. There's nothing wrong with God micromanaging. Because God micromanages perfectly. That means every detail of our lives, every moment of our days is planned. It's preordained by God. You and I are the objects and beneficiaries of Romans 8:28, that familiar verse, that all things work together for good. And God works those things together for our good and ultimately for His glory. That means that when we find ourselves in the labyrinth of life, when we find ourselves hitting dead ends, we can exercise patience, we can exercise hope in the surety, the certainty of God's management and His oversight. And knowing that, we can look to God's ultimate glory, knowing that He's working all things to our good. Let's close in prayer. Lord God, we thank You that we have a God who loves us enough to micromanage us. Lord, forgive us for those times when we cling to some thought that we're autonomous, to some mistaken belief that we have the right to rule our own lives, to make our own choices. Lord, may we constantly look for Your will. May we search Your word and be governed by it. Lord, when we recognize pride in our lives, may we deal with it and humble ourselves before You before that pride leads us down the same road of destruction. Lord, we pray that You watch over us this week, that You allow us to see Your hand in our lives, and we pray this in Your name. Amen.